The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for January 14th, 2017. Our first guest has a most famous surname and is a celebrated person in his own right. But it's difficult not to at least mention his legendary father, if only for winning 5 Tours de France and for his fiercely competitive qualities. So as you might have surmised, I am talking about Eddy Merckx, and today I have the distinct honor of speaking with his son, Axel. Axel retired from a very respectable pro racing career, winning an Olympic medal as well as many podiums, but it's what he's done since that retirement that has been most notable, as his Action Huggins-Berman team has racked up some impressive wins, including a 2016 season that saw 35 victories, 13 jersey classifications, 8 national titles, 3 team titles, and 3 riders who joined the World Tour ranks. I had an opportunity to speak with Axel this week. He's out in Calabasas, California with his team for spring training. We will catch up with him in a moment. After a short break, I'm going to head on out to the boonies of Colorado, where we meet up with a world champion Packboro racer. Now, one would think that this has virtually nothing to do with bicycles. One would be wrong. Hal Walter, who came to me via our mutual friend Patrick Mad Dog O'Grady, is a multi-time Packboro racing champion. He's also a talented writer and journalist, as well as the father of a 12-year-old son named Harrison. In his book of essays titled Endurance, we meet Harrison, who is, as Hal puts it, neurodiverse. For those who know the term, it describes a wide range of possible issues, and for those who don't, the term in most common use is autistic. Hal found himself the stay-at-home dad, and his life with Harrison has been filled with trials, tribulations, and successes, as Harrison has competed in triathlon, run cross-country, and eventually learned to ride a bike on his own. He also has his relationship with his own Packboro. It's a fascinating, heartbreaking, and heartwarming story. So let's head on out to Calabasas, California, to speak with director sportif of the Action Team, as it's known, Axel Merckx. Axel, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited that you can take some time to talk with me today. I know everybody must ask you as soon as they meet you a question or some variation, so I can't resist. So what's it like to have Eddy Merckx as your dad?
it's a question I've been used to a little bit, but, you know, as the years goes by, you know, you can attempt to appreciate even more, you know, the legacy that he left in cycling, and what is it to go and try to make your job out of something that, you know, first of all, you're passionate about, and that's what he was able to do in a brilliant way. And I'm trying to do the same thing for myself and to make him proud. You know, it's big shoes to fill, and you know, as an athlete, it was everybody will agree that it's impossible to come in his footsteps. But, you know, first of all, it's a great honor, and he's a great dad, so. It's a lot of fun to have somebody like that, you know, just always having my back and helping me out in good and bad times.
Now, he's in Europe and you're in the States right now, right? You live actually in Canada, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, so how often do you get to actually see him?
Oh, you know, we see each other about, I would say, like 3 to 4 times a year. You know, I always try to combine the trips with the team with some family time over there. And then, you know, I'll take a couple of trips just especially to go see him. You know, we're in contact daily, almost daily, just to talk to each other and just to catch up on little things in life and just to see, you know, he's very passionate also and eager to find out how it's going with the team here and how the riders are doing. So it's always good to have him in your side of the field.
Yeah, no kidding. So let's talk about you and your team. I'd like you to just let our listeners know a little bit, besides being the son of Eddie Merckx, you in your own right were a great pro rider and brought home an Olympic medal and lots of podiums. Tell me a little bit about your background as a bike racer before you became a team manager.
Well, I was a professional cyclist for 14 years. And, you know, like I said before, you know, I was very lucky to be able to make a job out of something I was really passionate about. You know, obviously it was not very, very easy to carry that name in cycling, but I'm still pretty proud of my accomplishment in cycling. You know, you mentioned bronze medal in the Olympics, which was, you know, probably the top of the list there. Stage win in the Giro d'Italia, in the Dauphiné Libéré, and a national championship in Belgium, which, you know, you get to carry the national jersey for 1 year is a huge pride for any nationality. So, you know, but most of all, it's just that I was able to have a lot of fun and meet incredible people through that whole path that I still use today to run and manage a team.
And that's really what I want to talk about, your team and the work that you're doing with young riders. You've committed your work to developing sort of the next generation of great cyclists. And I know you use a variety of criteria, including some results and data and a rider's temperament. Does your gut feeling ever come into play when you meet a new rider or see a new rider and you say, you know, he needs to be on my team?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is kind of part of the equation. You know, you get people, especially as the program has been growing and has been so successful. You know, you've been proposed and introduced to many, many riders and also many, many numbers and data, like you said. But at the end of the day, you know, you need to have a bunch of good people on your side that will advise you and help you out and give you a little bit of background information of the rider itself and to make sure that he would fit the mentality and the team spirit that we have in the team. And to be honest with you, also sometimes it happens naturally that, you know, some riders decide not to come to us because of the way we run the team and because we are a team and we only race for the team and not for one individual at all times. It could scare a few people away and decide to do something else. And that's fine. That's actually a good decision to make because we will not change our spirit of the team because it's been working for so well for so long that, you know, like it's like a family. It's you're part of the family. And if you're not willing to do that, then it's better you go somewhere else. But you know what I have the most pride of is that regardless if you make it to the Pro Tour or Pro Conti level, you know, once you pass here, you know, even if you go a different route, like you start going back to school or you start working, then those guys still, you know, appreciate the time that they had with the team and they're still part of the family and they still contact either me or people of the staff to keep in touch because they really feel like they was a great time in their life and they're part of the alumni family.
If we were to say the numbers today, how many team riders do you have and how many have sort of left the team but still stay in touch, like you say? I guess I'm asking how long the team has been riding together.
So the program started in 2009. That was the first year, and it was built around Taylor Finney, You know, it was linked together with Lance's comeback to the to the racing scene, and he wanted to have some organization around Taylor Finney because he was the next big talent, and that's how the team got built. And then after a couple of years, you know, I realized that this program can be more than just about one rider; it could be about a whole generation. And so we started developing that and increasing the knowledge and also the exposure of several riders from all over the world. We had originally some, like 12 riders on the team, and now we were able to grow the program where we have 16 riders on the team. And like, for example, last year, you know, we had 16 riders at the beginning of the season, and this year 50% of those 16 are new riders. So it's a huge turnover, and it's a big challenge to keep the mentality going. But I have to be honest with you, you know, I have great staff that works with me, and that you know, it's a well-oiled machine, and you know, we all get along very well. We all have a lot of fun doing what we're doing, and I think you can sense that in the little videos or the picture that we kind of relay on social media, and the riders just catch on really easily on that.
What would you say your basic rules are for your riders? I mean, obviously, as the manager of the team, you set down a specific program, but there are rules that you're going to follow and ask your riders to follow. What are some of those rules?
Well, the first rule that I have is communication. There has to be constant communication between all of us, whether it's between the staff and the riders and the management. The staff and the management, it has to be an open communication, and any suggestion is a good suggestion. You know, this program was not made by me. This program is not about me. This program is about all the alumni that participate in this team. They've all contributed to the growth and the improvement of the program. You know, that's one of the things that I always tell them, like, this is not necessarily my team. This is everybody's team. This is all the riders' team. And if they feel that the program can improve by making some adjustments, I'm more than happy to have the input. Same with the staff. Also, they're always welcome to come to my knock on my door and to make some suggestions to see how we can improve it. And I think that's what made this program the identity of not just one person, but just a whole family of alumni, I would say.
Well, you certainly had some amazing success in 2016. You had 35 victories, 13 jersey classifications, 8 national titles, 3 team titles, 3 riders went to the World Tour ranks. What are in your plans for 2017? I mean, how are you going to top that?
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. That's a big shoes to fill again. But you know what? That's what makes this program so exciting. It's just to push a reset button. And I'm not saying that, you know, we're going to have the same season as last year, because we never know. We're the same as you guys. We don't really know how those new guys will adjust to the program and how well they will do. And you know, but I'm still confident that we have a lot of talent here, and we have great partners that will help develop those guys also in a good and positive way. And whether it's going to be this season or next season, you know, I know that all those guys that are on the team, they do have the talent, they do have whatever it takes to make it to the Pro Conti or World Tour level. And, you know, whether it's going to work or not, it's really going to be up to them. And sometimes you need to have a little bit of luck on your side, but we will try to support them the best way we can just to get them there.
Who might we be looking at this year? Who are some of the riders who you think will sort of stand out this year? Are they the same as last year? You did send 3 riders to the World Tour. Who should we be watching this year?
Well, it's very hard for me to give you exactly who it's going to be, because, you know, like I said, this is not about just one person or two person or even 3 riders. This is about a whole group of guys that do have a lot of talent. What I can tell you, though, is that, you know, based on what we saw last year with Adrian Costa and Nielsen Paulus and Logan Owen, you know, those guys have performed already really well in 2016. So we know that we have those assets, and then we know the value of those riders so far. And now it's up to them to confirm and even, you know, improve, because there's still some work to be done. It's great to have results here in North America, but we'll try to get some results further beyond, like in Europe and stuff like that. And then, you know, it's also up to those guys to show some leadership and to get actually those that new generation and those new riders to elevate to the level of their performance from last year, and hopefully getting some results for themselves too. And that will say a lot about those guys, that we'll be able to lead those guys in a positive way and in growth of their development also.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Axel Merckx. He is the director sportif of the Action Huggins Berman team. I want to kind of just move in a different direction for a moment and ask you a little bit about sponsorship and equipment. Sponsorship has been a big problem for a lot of teams. How are you able to keep your team in great equipment and good training and cars and all the things? Who are your sponsors?
Well, we have a bunch of great partners. You know, we've had we have SRAM as an equipment manager since day one. They were a longest standing partner that we've had since 2009, and we've always worked with them. We've developed some ETAP wireless system together with them. So we've not only been partner, you know, in the racing, but also behind the scenes and trying to develop their product. But most importantly, you know, we have also great partners like Huggins Berman, which we have Steve Berman on our side. That he's a huge cycling fan, and he really enjoys the development side of things. And he's been a great partner. And if you've seen those results that like we had last year, he's the one of the foundation of that development and improvement of the team, because he allowed us to increase the level of performance of the riders, the exposure that they had, and that was a great asset. And then we have Neon Adventure, which is a British group that he's really passionate about cycling too, but also about youth and development. And all our websites have been built and developed by them, so they're a great deal about the image and the exposure of the riders, and they're also great. Great cyclists themselves, because they participate in our training camp and they're actually really good riders themselves. So that's really good to have some partner like that involved in our daily training here in California. And then you know, we have Specialized Bikes, and they've been with us for the second year now, and we've built, I think, a really good relationship over the last year, and the results spoke for themselves. It's a great company with a great marketing view and you know, a great desire to invest and develop youth of cycling in North America, but also in the world. And we're really excited to have those guys on board. And then we have, you know, other sponsors like Cal Giant that have been investing and developing into youth cycling for many, many years. And they just still wanted to be involved in youth cycling after they decided to not run their own team and but still being involved in development. So we've had and we still have great partners, and basically what they believe in is cycling and development of cycling and the future of cycling. And that's they believe, and luckily for us, they believe that our program is one of the best paths for North American riders to make their way up.
Well, it's obvious that it's been successful, so it's nice to be able to give them returns on their investments, and it seems to work really well as a give-and-take relationship. I want to ask you a little bit about how you think cycling's changed since you were in the Peloton. So you raced back in the day. Today, it's a whole new group of riders, a whole new sort of the UCI is trying to figure out whether they should drop a race or add this. How has cycling itself, do you think it's changed a lot?
Well, I think cycling is changed in some ways, and it hasn't changed in the other way. I think that, you know, you keep seeing some races come and go and becoming more and more international and expanding their broadcast over the whole world, which is a positive thing, and also attracting sponsors that a little bit further than the spectrum from when we were around. Like when I was racing, you know, it was more European and let's say North American base. Now we know we start reaching the Middle East. We even start going to China and stuff like that. So that's all positive things for the development on the business side of cycling. But I think there is still a lot of work that has to be done, and starting with leadership and starting with the governing body. I think what I would like to see for the future of cycling is a little bit more input of the riders themselves into the something as simple as election of the president of the UCI, for example. Why can't a rider have his say about who he thinks is the best person to run the governing body? I'm not saying they should have all the say, but I think they should have some kind of say. Same with the trade teams, they should have their say in there too. So I think there has to be somebody in the world of cycling that is willing to take that up with the governing body and just to explain that cycling is not the same that it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. We need to evolve. We need to get it more exciting for the viewer also. And I think there's some change in that direction, but I think it has to be pushed way further than it is right now. And there's still lots of work that has to be done, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I appreciate you saying it, because from your perspective, it comes from a whole different view from, say, looking in it from the outside as a journalist. And I've been, I report on it, but I'm not really in it, so I don't get to see what you get to see. I'm going to, quote unquote, change gears here for a second. I'm going to ask you that if a listener, a young man, was listening to this conversation and said, I would love to be on the action team, what is it that you would give him or even her as a piece of advice to become a great cyclist?
The fundamental of cycling is very simple. In my mind is you have to enjoy and you have to love the sport. You have to love and enjoy riding your bike. That's the first step. And if you're that passionate about it and you're willing to put the work into it, and there is, you have to make some compromises, especially when you can still go to school and stuff. You still have to be organized and to make sure that you get your schooling done and you still find time to ride your bike. But if you're really passionate about it, you will drop some other maybe real life or different kind of lifestyle in order to become a cyclist. And I think that's the fundamental of it, that you want to, if you're really passionate about it and you're willing to put the work into it, you do have a chance to make a career out of it. Unfortunately, not everybody can do it, but at least if you don't give it your best, then you will never know if you can get there. And then eventually the results will show up, and you'll be picked up by one of the development teams that then can see your commitment and also your talent in the making.
Yeah, that's really good advice, I think. I think that's really, really good advice. I'm glad you said that. Thanks. So I'm going to ask you the usual weirdo questions. What's your favorite food?
Oh, as a real Belgian guy, I would have to say steak fries and mayonnaise.
That's good. At least you didn't say pizza. What kind of music do you like to listen to?
I'm a bit of an... I wouldn't say old school, but my European will come out of this. And I have two teenage daughters, 11 and 15 year old, that kind of like to listen to the regular pop music on the radio, But I'm a huge fan of Coldplay. I really like them, and I really enjoy listening to them. So that's really my style of music.
Wow, how about pets? Do you have any pets?
Yeah, I do have a dog. I've always kind of grown up with the dogs at home, and we've had a couple dogs so far in the family. And I have a real mutt, I would say, kind of mixed between Border Collie and Shepherd, and having lots of fun with the kids with it.
Well, this has just been a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate you taking time. I wish the team and you a lot of luck in 2017. We'll keep watching. And so Sean, who is the guy who always helps put these interviews together for me, has promised me we get to talk with some of your riders later on in the season. And that's going to be fun, too. So thanks so much, Axel. Have a great afternoon, and I hope it stops raining out there so you can get back out on the road.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you calling me. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Axel Merks joined me from team training in Calabasas, California. It was wonderful to talk with him. Of course, he is the son of the great Eddie Merks, but he seems to be a guy with his head on his shoulders pretty squarely. We need to take a break, and then we will be back to talk with Hal Walter in Colorado. We're going to talk about jackasses. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On January 21st and 28th, Lake Erie Inc., a writing space for youth, and Dobama Theater are teaming up to host a two-part youth playwriting workshop. Finished works will be submitted to the Marilyn Bianchi Kids Playwriting Festival, which accepts original play submissions from 1st through 12th graders from Cuyahoga County and then produces the winning plays at their summer festival. Young writers will have the chance to work with internationally known playwright Katie O'Keefe during this two-part workshop. A small registration fee is required. Registration and more information at lakeerieinc.org.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. I'm going to head on out to the boonies of Colorado, where we meet up with a world champion pack burro racer. Hello, Hal Walter. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. You want to have some fun?
Yes. Thank you, Diane. Happy to be here.
Oh, good. Where are you? You're in Colorado.
We're in Colorado, in Westcliff, Colorado, which is in kind of the south central mountains, southwest of Colorado Springs, about 70 miles. And if you went to a map and looked at Pueblo and went about 50 miles west, we're up in the mountains just due west of Pueblo.
It sounds to me kind of wildernessy.
It's a pretty rural existence. I moved here, let's see, 26 years ago, and it's actually become more developed since. When I first moved here, the local ranch didn't have fences for its horses, and they just wandered over to our place, and there were a lot fewer houses out here. I couldn't see another house from where we live when I first moved here.
That's kind of cool in a way.
It is, and it's kind of funny to see the area become a little neighborhood, and to have made friendships with the neighbors.
You're the pioneer.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about this, that, and the other, and I'm thinking, well, I remember when your property wasn't even fenced. You know?
Well, you know, any friend of Patrick O'Grady, Mr. Mad Dog, and he's the one who told me I really needed to talk to you. You have some interesting things to say. You are a writer. You have some wonderful essays in a book called Endurance, and it's not what people might think. It's about enduring life in a way. Even though our show's about cycling, and your son Harrison is also the cyclist, and that's where the bicycle sort of connection is going to come in, this really is a conversation more about you and what it's like to have a son who is challenged and who is making his parents' life kind of challenging. Let's talk a little bit about your experience as a dad and the fact that maybe you didn't expect to be a dad.
I didn't, and I like to say I was a reluctant parent. It was never in my life plans to have children, and Harrison came as sort of a surprise late in life. I was 44 when he was born, and in irony of all ironies, he turned out to be a real challenge. And I've read recently where having one autistic kid is equivalent to raising 10 children, and I actually believe that.
I don't know. I have to say my daughter's best friend has two, and both of them are, as they say, on the spectrum. And I do want to talk about that because that's a really important part of how you describe what's going on. You don't really like the word autism. You like the word neurodiverse.
I prefer neurodiverse because it's more inclusive. And I think that there are a lot of people out there who are neurodiverse, and whether you want to include people with ADHD is real popular right now. Sensory integration disorder is a real popular thing. I know I myself have battled with obsessive compulsive disorder most of my life. And you know, all these things are really just the same thing, brains that don't work typically to other people. And so to say one person is autistic and another person has ADHD, I think is really kind of splitting hairs. And I think that you can also look at a lot of people, and my son is a great example of this, who is formally diagnosed as autistic, but he's also diagnosed as ADHD. And I can tell you he has a very, very strong obsessive compulsive component as well. So just to call somebody autistic and let the world think that they all act like Rain Man is kind of a simplistic overview of the whole thing.
Yeah, it sounds very, very complicated. And yet, I've read several of your essays, and they usually have included Harrison. And I haven't actually read the other book we're going to talk about, Full Tilt Boogie. But do you think that defining a child by a place on a spectrum leads to pigeonholing the child and leading to being maybe treated differently and perhaps badly by others?
Well, or just there are certain expectations about the person. And I like to call this thing, I actually just sent an email to a friend this morning. I like to call it Rain Man Syndrome, where people see, for instance, the movie Rain Man. And they take away from that all autistic people can't stand noise, they can't stand neon lights, and they're all some sort of mathematical genius. And thus, that's the stereotype of autistic people, and it's maybe true for one, it may be true for a lot, but it's not necessarily true for every person on the spectrum. They're all different, and I've now, you know, through taking Harrison to various therapies, sitting in waiting rooms, seeing other kids on the spectrum, I've realized that they're all different. Everybody's so different. And truly, aren't we all different, even those of us who are allegedly neurotypical?
Neurotypical, nice word. Neurodiverse, I like that. That's really cool. Yeah, I think you're right. So I thought this was very interesting. Your experience with Harrison, with his school, I don't know how you lucked into this school situation, because I know that that's not the experience of a lot of parents. They don't always mainstream their children. But your Harrison has been mainstreamed, and it seems like the school kind of rose up and took him in.
They did, and, you know, it started early. And I have to say, Mary, my wife, was very instrumental early on. She was on to this. She's a nurse anyway, and very well versed in child development, and so she knew something was off. And I took the denial route. That, oh, he's just, you know, he's learning late. You know, he's walking late. He's talking late. You know, and I had lots of help with this. In fact, you know, friends who grew up to be surgeons are telling me, oh, I didn't talk till I was five and stuff like that, but. But Mary was calling in the help early, and as a result, we were able to get him into preschool early. In fact, I think he was like 3 and a half when he started preschool. And of course, the preschool was run by the school district here. And so he was right there with the neurotypical kids from the beginning, and most of these kids are still in his class. I mean, some of them moved away. We've had some new people move in, but a lot of these kids have known him since he was three. And you know, we talk about the school, and the school has done a great job, but I also have to say that the kids, his friends, have done a really great job too. But they really kept him in a mainstream situation. We had a IEP. Individualized education program for him early on, and the goal was to keep him in the mainstream class as much as possible. Now, in the last year, we have had to go to some special education for some of his classes. There are some of his classes he's doing outside of the classroom, mostly because it's just not, for instance, appropriate to expect Harrison to have the same reading comprehension as the other kids. And so he has his own reading program now. That's one example. He was also having some difficulty in, of all things, PE this last year. And so he's been taken out of the mainstream PE for a couple months, and it looks like he's going to go back in there here in the spring.
That is interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Hal Walter. He lives out in the boonies in Colorado. He is a writer. He is the father of a neurodiverse 12-year-old. He's 12, right?
He's 12.
Yeah, just wait. Teenage years are coming up. I know that one of the things that I thought was very interesting about Harrison is that he's very athletic. He rides a bike. He did a triathlon. In fact, I want you to tell the story about him learning to ride a bike, because it didn't happen for a long time, and then all of a sudden it happened instantly.
Well, it didn't. And, to back up, there's a school triathlon, and it starts in, fourth grade. So fourth graders, fifth graders, and sixth graders all have the opportunity to participate in the school triathlon. And it's held in the spring, and they actually take the afternoon off from school. The entire community comes out to watch. It starts in the local pool. We have a health club here with a pool. And you get out, and they have the transition in the parking lot. And you ride your bike down this little trail system over to the school. And then the first year, it was just one lap around the track was the run. And then the second 2 years, it was two laps around the track. And, all along, we've been trying to help him ride a bike. He's always had a bike with training wheels. We tried that. We tried the just one training wheel technique. People said, just get rid of the training wheels and he'll learn. And we tried that, and it didn't work. The first year of the triathlon, I was given through a local bike shop in Pueblo a tag-along for my mountain bike. They're very, very generous down there, and they just gave me this tag-along. So the first year, I got special permission to be the balance for Harrison's bike leg of the triathlon, which meant I kept the bike going just enough that we didn't fall over and made him do, most of the pedaling. And then the second year was coming around, and now I'm already looking at three-wheelers. And his piano teacher actually has a three-wheeler. And so he had been borrowing that from her some days after piano lessons. She would let him take her three-wheel bike out and ride it around. She's a retired music teacher, and we take him to piano lessons there once a week. And so she started letting him ride her bike after the lesson. And it was amazing to see the sudden freedom that he had on this big three-wheel bike. And he just motored around. It actually kind of scared me, because that thing looked more unstable than a regular bike.
Yeah, they are, actually.
But he could balance on it, and he could really go. And I started shopping for him, and I thought, wow, this is just, a lot of expense to go to, and he might, he might learn to ride a bike if he doesn't have one of these. And I was even looking at the big, because we live out on a dirt road, I'm looking at the $1,500 big fat tire, three-wheel bike. And then we had bought a BMX bike for him. And I remember when I was a kid, I was late to ride a bicycle myself. It just wasn't something that my parents encouraged me to do, or anybody, and I was kind of a loner as a kid. At one point in time, my mom, being a single mom, had acquired a bike from a friend at work or something like that. And it was a girl's bike, a big English girl's three-speed. And the way I learned to ride that bike was I pushed it to the top of our driveway, and I just straddled the bike with both feet out, and I let it go a little ways, and if I had to put my foot down, I did. And I just did this over and over and over until one time I coasted a little ways, and then, the next time I coasted halfway down the driveway, and then I think I coasted the whole way down the driveway. Next thing I knew, I was pedaling, and I could ride the thing. And you know how that old saying goes, how's it go? You can't
You never forget how to ride a bike.
Right, it's like that. Well, we had this BMX bike for him, and we have a slight incline on our road right in front of our driveway, and I started encouraging him to do that, and I got my own bike out, and side by side, we went down the thing, and he would never get very far. And this went on forever, and now the second year of the school triathlon's coming up. It's like March, and the triathlon is, I think, at the end of April, or maybe early May. But we're out there, and then one evening, it just happens. He just suddenly coasts all the way to the end, and he starts riding his bike.
Huh.
And so I'm thinking, he was 9.
Wow.
9 or 10, yeah. And the next thing you know, he's pedaling back up the hill, and it took him a while to get the muscle development going on. And within a week, he was wanting to ride it. We live next to this big ranch with all these horse trails on there, very difficult trails to ride on a mountain bike. Within a week, he's out there riding those and going through gullies and, you know, single track uphill, and it was astounding.
Making up for lost time.
Yeah, yeah. And so therefore he was able to ride his bike that year in the triathlon. And sort of a funny story and a story of community, we went out the day before and rode that because I knew there was some loose gravel on the back side of the lap around the stadium that he had to do. And I tried to explain to him finding a line through the firmer ground so he didn't bog down in that gravel. And so I thought we had it down. And the second year, I rode my bike kind of, I stayed back, but I just wanted to be out there in case something went wrong. And we got to this area of gravel, and I pointed, okay, find the line. And first thing he did was he turned his wheel into that gravel and came to a complete stop. And he went into a tantrum, and the other kids were cheering him on. And this continued. He got going again, but he was still mad, and it continued on over to the transition area. He was still stomping around when he got off his bike, and now he's got to go run. And he starts out running, and he's still in a tantrum. And there was a small crowd of high school girls standing nearby. And one of them, you know, they were just chatting, and one of them took notice to all this and came running over and ran the two laps with him. And then after finishing, just like it was just part of an everyday occurrence, just ran back over and back with her friends, talking again.
Wow.
And you know how conscientious high school girls can be.
Or not.
And I just found that to be an incredible statement. I didn't even know who this person was. And I thought, wow, what a really fine young lady.
No kidding.
To take that effort to go do that with an autistic boy having a problem.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Hal Walter. We're talking about his son, Harrison, who at the age of 9, evidently, did a triathlon, learned to ride a bike. And his son is neurodiverse, or as a lot of people use the term, autistic. I don't know that I will ever use that term again. I'm kind of liking the new one. There's another thread to this story that really is what started me down the path of finding you. It's about something about jackasses, and it's actually about burros and pack burros, and you hold some records for racing pack burros, and Harrison evidently has his own burro?
Well, sort of. To back up and tell the story, here in Colorado, there's a crazy adventure sport called pack burro racing. It started in 1949, and the first race, to give you just a little bit of an idea, the first race ever held was held from the mining town of Leadville over Mosquito Pass, which is 13,187 feet high, to the town of Fairplay. And the distance is 23 miles. And the rules are that you may not ride the burro. You can run with it, hike with it, or whatever, but you may not ride it, and you're going on foot the whole way. I got involved with pack rural racing in 1980 through a friend of mine who I was running a marathon with, and I've been at it ever since. I have run, we now, the point-to-point race doesn't happen anymore. Each of the towns now have their own individual races. It's a little circuit called the Triple Crown of Pack Rural Racing. And my first race was in Leadville, where the sport originated in 1980, and the race now is 22 miles. It still goes up to the top of Mosquito Pass, and I have finished that race every year since 1980 with no, haven't missed one of them.
Wow.
I've won it several times. Now, on the other side of the pass in Fairplay, the race is known as the World Championship Pack Rural Race, and it's 29 miles, so it's longer than a marathon. It also goes to the top of the same pass, and I've run that. I've run in that every year since 1981, and there were 2 years I didn't finish the race, but I've won it 7 times.
That's so cool. We were talking about this in my yoga class. So the genus of the animal is A-S-I-N-U-S, asinus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the term ass comes from, I guess?
Right.
Okay. But you call them burros?
Burro is Spanish for donkey. Well, most people would know a burro is a donkey in the world. And in back east, the term donkey is more common, I think, than out west, where we have a history of wild burros. When the miners came out and were prospecting for precious metals, gold and silver, et cetera, they often turned their burros loose after they were either struck it rich or were foiled and went back to civilization. They just turned the burros loose, and we had these wild herds of burros that roam out here, especially in Arizona, but also even in Northern California, New Mexico, Oregon. There are herds of wild burros. And so the term burro is pretty prevalent out here in the West, which is, it's just a Spanish for donkey.
Do you own burros?
So I own 2 burros. I'm actually training a burro here for a friend, and might race it this summer. So I have 3 here at my place, and try to get each of them out for a couple, 3 training runs every weekly. So I'm quite active with running the burros.
Tell us how the burro and Harrison interact. There is one specific burro that he tends to interact with?
Well, we have one burro that's older and is just more well-trained and less flappable. And his name is Laredo. And I've actually won that world championship race twice with Laredo. And Laredo is a pretty big burro, and he's big enough for actually even for me to ride. And so Harrison rides him quite often. And when Harrison was really young, you know, one of the things that I was already missing was my connection with the backcountry and the outdoors and the high mountains. And so we started him riding early on, as early as we thought he could ride. And we started out with hiking. We'd take one of those baby backpacks and then maybe let him ride the burro for a short while and then back to the backpack. And we very, very gradually worked into this program where he could ride for pretty long distances. And when he was 3 years old, we went on an overnight pack trip over Music Pass, which is in the Sangre de Cristo Range over here. It's an 11,000-foot pass. And Harrison rode one of our burros, who has passed on now, Spike, over that pass when he was a little over 3 years old, 3.5 years old. And
wow.
Camped out overnight over there a couple nights and rode back. We also had the little backpack still at that point in time. And so, you know, there were some parts there where he took a break from riding, and Mary and I each took turns carrying him a little bit. But that was the beginning of his connection with the Burroughs. And, you know, since then he has ridden into, I mean, a lot of the high lakes up there. You know, most of our lakes are right about that elevation of that music pass, you know, close to 11,000 feet, some of them maybe even over. And he's ridden a burro into a number of those high lakes and for camping trips and fishing trips and just for fun, you know, sometimes a day hike will go up there. There was a day when he was in fifth grade when they had a teacher planning day, and it was a nice fall day, and he and I took that, and he rode Laredo into Comanche Lake and back, which is about a 5 mile in, 5 mile out. And there were some parts of that ride where there was a little bit of snow in some of the shady spots up there. I didn't want him riding, and he just insisted he was going to ride the whole way in and out of that lake trail.
I wish we had tons and tons more time to talk, because I know you have lots of things to talk about, and they're all really interesting and related to so many other things. And even though we don't have a super, super strong cycling connection, I think all of us who have children especially, and maybe those who don't, are going to learn something from what you have to say. I'd like you to tell our listeners about your writing. You have this book of essays, Endurance. Is that published now?
It is, and it's available on Amazon.com. And Endurance, I guess, writing about my experiences as a autism dad has become a real focus for me. And as Harrison became involved in sports, and certainly there are two essays in Endurance that involve cycling, and one that touches upon the triathlon. But when he was in fifth grade, his fourth grade teacher from the year before asked him to be on the cross country team as he went into middle school. There's a middle school cross country team. And thus we started on a whole nother adventure with him running in cross country and on the track team.
Yeah, I don't want you to give that all away. I'd like people to read it. I read the entire thing, and it is fascinating.
Well, what I guess the bottom line is, I found that we were going out to these other communities, because when you live in the mountains in Colorado, every town has its high school or its middle school and its team. And so to have a meet, you've got all these different teams traveling to another town. And what I found was that we had a support system that wasn't just his team and his community here, but this larger region, and that we were also providing sort of a service of showing the world what he's all about. You know, here he's, you know, has some real challenges, and yet he's able to compete on the school teams. And it never occurred to me that he would be on a team or do a sport.
That'll learn you, Dad.
Yeah, and what I found is there's a whole other side to winning than just coming in first.
No kidding.
And that's what I think deep sport is about, and that's a part of the subtitle to that book, that there's a lot to learn from sports and the human interactions that are brought about by sport.
Well, I'd really like to continue following how Harrison does going forward as he begins to approach these teenage years and then on. I imagine you will continue writing about your experiences with him. What do you think the big future hurdle is for you and Marion Harrison?
Well, I think it's the great unknown. And it was interesting, on one of our voyages over to the San Luis Valley, which is literally on the other side of the mountain range that I just described, where he took his first overnight pack trip. There's a town over there by the name of Alamosa. We had a track meet over there, and we drove by, and there's a small college over there, Adams State University. And we were driving by there last spring, and I thought, you know, will Harrison ever go to college? And I thought, well, if he did, it might have to be a small school like this, you know, and how interesting if, for instance, I needed to go back to school when I'm 62, so that he can go back to school. It's the same way I'm reliving cross country. I never ran cross country in high school myself, but I'm having that experience now through him, and the idea that he will ever be fully functional on his own is still, you know, still out there. We don't know.
Well, he keeps surprising you.
He does. He does. And it might be that one day he jumps in a car or waves and drives off to college, and that would be great if he does. And if he doesn't want to go to college and wants to do something else, that's fine too. But we'll just have to see how much guidance and help he needs at that point in time. And, man, I have no idea. And I think that's a big challenge for anybody with a child like this, is you just don't know what the future holds. And you hear stories of kids snapping out of it. Just, you know, suddenly one day they're almost normal again, you know. And
like suddenly one day he got on a bike and rode.
Exactly. And then you also hear the other end of the thing. So you just don't really know what to expect. And I think you just have to take it day to day and be prepared for anything. It's just like even a trip to the grocery store with Harrison. You don't know how that's going to go. But like going to track or anything else, I continue to take him to the grocery store. Someday I think maybe, you know, he might need to go in a grocery store and buy some food for himself.
That's really cool. I hope that happens, and I hope you continue to enjoy, even though it's challenging, you know, the lifestyle that you've chosen. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I think we will talk again. Good luck with Harrison and your burros. I would love to have a burro. I don't think they'll let me have one where we live, though.
You have to have a big yard.
Yeah, we don't have that. A big yard. You mean like the whole mountainside, right?
Right. Thank you for having me on your show, Diane.
Well, Hal, thank you so much. And you have a great day. Hope you get over that cold. And take care. Bye-bye. Hal Walter joined me from his home in Colorado, where he and the burros and Harrison get up into the mountains and do all kinds of cool stuff. His book, again, is Endurance. It's a series of really well-written and interesting essays with some great photographs of Harrison included. I'd like to also thank our first guest for this evening, Axel Merckx, who is the director sportif of the Action Hoggins Berman team. And we'll be back next week with a brand new show. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, if it's nice where you are and you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.